I'm David Kern.
I'm Heidi White.
I'm Kim McIntosh.
And I'm Sean Johnson.
And you are listening to Close Reads, a podcast for the incurable reader, on which we are discussing Cormac McCarthy's novel, The Road, his Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, and we are, in particular, discussing the end of the book. Well, the whole book. We have the whole thing in front of us now, and we can discuss, spoil it, if so to speak. We can talk about all of it.
Nice.
Tim is actually on the road right now. He is...
That's right.
He is, like the characters in this book, somewhere in the mountains, where the connection is poor and the ash is flowing freely. Is that right? Did I get that right, Tim?
That's exactly right. And I'm actually in a car, like our main characters lived for various evenings in a burned out car. Mm. That's what I'm doing. I'm podcasting from a car.
But are you hotboxing in this car?
Oh boy. And I'm hotboxing in that car. Man, yeah. That is a throwback to like...
I know.
Year two or year three, isn't it?
That was back when I was a mere listener.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. So...
Laughing hysterically.
Tim...
The thought of you hotboxing.
There's a lot of people who
we can probably explain that.
Pass that over to you so we can get a couple laughs before we dig into the end of the road.
But Tim, maybe you should explain this as if you were living in the road at the time when this happened to you.
Oh gosh, that would be too complex a storytelling path for me. My car when I lived in Eugene, Oregon, was stolen two times. And each time it was stolen by people who just took it for a joyride so they could hotbox in the car. And then after 24 hours, they would leave it abandoned in a parking lot. And if you don't know what hotboxing is, I leave that up to your discretion to research.
But if you do, then you were concerned about Tim. Now you know that it wasn't actually him.
If you've ever lived in Eugene, Oregon,
because
you know what it is.
Because you specifically said on the podcast that you didn't know what hotboxing was and you had to find out, which I thought was really sweet.
After the police told you or what?
No. I think the police told me, but that message was reinforced when I stepped back into my car and I got the vapors like hitting me like a sledgehammer.
Yeah.
People probably know what hotboxing is by now.
Yeah.
Did you get that residue high?
I don't know. Was it a residue high? I don't know.
I mean, maybe you probably wouldn't remember it. So Tim is on the phone. He is in a ashy wasteland and therefore doesn't have Wi-Fi connection or any ability to use Zoom in the traditional way. So he is, as if it's 1957, calling in on a telephone. Am I getting that right?
That's right.
Okay. So that's why it sounds like it sounds like you're talking to your grandpa after the big game.
Way to go, champ.
We're here to discuss the end of the road, as I said. Before we get into that, I do want to read a couple of comments that we received on the Substack page. And this is kind of a letters to the editor. We still haven't come up with a good name for that.
How about post for the host?
Post for the host.
Ooh. Oh, yeah. That was a good one.
I like that.
That's from Mary Jo Tate.
Yeah,
host for the host.
Oh,
that's good job, Mary Jo. That's good. I didn't see that one. Let's do it. Let's just officially call it the post for the host's occasional segment. And what I'm going to do is just read some of them from Substack. One of the posts for the hosts did ask, "What's the difference between these posts for the hosts and the Q&A?" And you know, I'm glad you asked that question because, frankly, I had to think about it for a little while. And I came to the conclusion that I think the posts for the hosts are where we just give people a chance to sound off and it doesn't become like a whole conversation talking point. It doesn't even have to be a question on a Q&A. It's supposed to be a question. And then we try to answer the question or discuss it. Posts for the hosts, you can tell a joke about the road. You can, you can offer some kind of feedback. And then I'm just going to choose the ones that I like. That's basically how it's going to work. And will we discuss them? Maybe. Will we not discuss them? Maybe. I don't know. We'll see how it goes. So the nature of the post for the host segment is that it's a bit of a Wild West, I think is how I'm thinking about it.
I like this.
So we have a couple of episodes now of posts to draw from. And I'll just say our readers are very smart people who really care about these conversations. And so we get some great comments. So I just want to say bravo to everybody who's participating, and thank you for being a part of this world. Now, Tim, as I told you before we started recording, I can't see your face in this situation.
Right.
So I can't tell, right. You know, if you're not, I can't see you raise your hand. I can't, you know, I can't see you making a face, looking off into the distance, ready to say something. So in this case, you're just going to have to speak up if you want to compliment or insult these posts for the hosts. Okay.
Okay. Okay. I'm ready. I will make, I will vocalize my feelings.
Okay. That's great. Is that generally something you're good at?
Yes. When, okay. When given the liberty, I am, it's a strong skill set.
Okay, great. Okay. So, let's start with, this one here from Mark. He says, when I read about Eli the old man, I immediately thought of the role of Elijah in the Passover Seder ritual instead of Zeus, as I heard in the podcast. My understanding is that at the Passover ritual, an extra place is set for Elijah and a door is open to invite Elijah to enter. The traditional meaning is that Elijah arriving will hearken the arrival of the Messiah. Another meaning is that seat reminds us of the poor and the need to provide for them. I think the boy invited Elijah in and they provided what they could to him. I also think Eli identifies this story as a journey to a promised land. In the next scene, the find the train scene, which I take as supporting this concept because of the song People Get Ready. I was a little disappointed that you ended the discussion between the man and Eli a little early. I think one of the most profound statements is the counterpoint on the next page where it says, maybe he believes in God. I don't know what he believes in. He'll get over it. No, he won't. And Mark, I just want to say that's a great comment, and I feel your criticism and I appreciate the input and I feel bad. We stopped early. So, because you're right. That's a great passage, and I think it ties into some things that we might be talking about on this episode. Anybody want to comment on this, or should I just do another post for the host?
That's great. Keep them coming.
Do another post for the host. Yeah.
Okay. Let's do this one from Michelle. Eli's statement, there is no God and we are his prophets, reminded me of Nietzsche's, also often misquoted, God is deadline. Here's the full section. God is dead. God remains dead and we have killed him. How shall we comfort ourselves? The murderers of all murderers. What was holiest and mightiest of all that the world has yet owned has bled to death under our knives. Who will wipe this blood off us? End quote. That is to say, Michelle continues, once humanity has turned away from the ideal or the most pure, what have we to look towards to for hope and strive towards in virtue? In the case of the road, the majority of humanity has killed God by resorting to cannibalism and other atrocities, but the man, the boy, and Eli are still his prophets because they refuse to rescind their hold on goodness. They're still carrying the fire. So it was less of a contradiction for me and more of a philosophical statement. Now, she does say thoughts here, so I will give you a chance to offer any thoughts that you might have on this. Heidi, do you want to comment on this?
Yeah, I too thought of Nietzsche's words there. I think that there's a bigger question. Nietzsche seems to have, he doesn't seem to, he overtly says, God was invented by man and then killed by man, right? So essentially there is no God. And I think that the road is asking the question and leaves room for the divine without landing that there is a God, right? But I think it leaves room, and Nietzsche does not. But I heard the echoes, certainly, of Nietzsche's nihilist vision in that entire conversation, but I'm not convinced that the book itself settles on the idea that God is dead, or the reality that God is dead.
Well, okay, let's just use this post for the host comment to dig into that a little bit, because that is one of the big the accusations that is sometimes levied against Cormac McCarthy, and this book, though less so than some of his earlier work. Tim, you are in the camp that you would agree with Heidi, right?
Yes, I would agree. And I think that the second to last section of the book, for me, I'm not going to say it's like a clear and resounding answer, indisputable evidence, this is what McCarthy believes, but I think it leans one direction.
We're going to talk about whether this book is hopeful.
Yeah.
Here. We have to talk about that in this episode. Sean, any thoughts?
I mean, I'm also going to throw my hat in there for agreeing with Tim and Heidi and thinking that, that this book ends on a fairly objective note of hope and is maybe less despairing about the question raised in these scenes. I think that maybe to tie both of the posts to the host together, I think that the scene is a just a broad, or the character of Eli is a just broadly jabbing at religion generally, right? Eli isn't his given name. It's a name that he takes, and he takes it sort of scoffingly. And the God is dead and we are his prophets line is also a mockery of the Islamic mantra, right? That there is one God, or Allah is God and Muhammad is his prophet. So I think that he's just rolling all of those representative religious tropes up into a ball and you know, poking at the father with them to see what comes out.
There's a comment here from Jennifer, a post for the host, and this is on the first episode's page. She says, Heidi, I'm so glad that you mentioned starting the road previously and laying it aside part of the way through, and that you Googled what happened to the boy. I seriously considered giving up the quarter of the way through, partially because I feared what lay in store since the first quarter was already intense. I also looked up what happened to the son because I had to know. Due to the encouragement of fellow readers, I finished the book. Thank you for sharing that it wasn't easy for you either. So good job, Heidi.
Good job, Heidi.
I just wanted to share that.
Good.
And then lastly, here's one more that we'll do. And this is a little, it's two technically, but it's kind of a little back and forth of sorts between Mark and Ed. And Mark says, I also appreciate the discussion that the working title was the Grail. It leads me to ask, is the boy the Grail, or are they searching for the Grail? I think you danced around that question, but I would love each of your opinions. When the boy talks about carrying the fire, I think he must be the Grail. However, the journey and the desire to find salvation, or at least a place to live, makes me think they are searching. What do you think? Ed then comments, that's going to be where we go next, but Ed did comment, like they discussed, I think that the working title is multivalent, but by first reaction, it is to see the Grail as the boy, mostly based upon passages like these. And he reads two passages that I think are good. He sat beside him and stroked his pale and tangled hair, golden chalice, good to house a god. And then they talked hardly at all. He coughed all the time and the boy watched him spitting blood, slumping along, filthy, ragged, hopeless. He'd stop and lean on the cart and the boy would go on and then stop and look back and he would raise his weeping eyes and see him standing there in the road looking back at him from some unimaginable future, glowing in that waste like a tabernacle. So let's use that post for the host to jump into our conversation today. Is the boy the Grail, or are they searching for the Grail? Sean, you said yes. You answered the question with two options with a yes, but dig into that one.
Well, they're looking for we don't have to spoil it. We can spoil things. When they meet, when the boy meets the other survivors at the end, the first thing he asks them is if they are also carrying the fire. And one of the ways that fire is used as a metaphor in education is that it's this great picture of something that can be kindled and multiplied without diminishing itself. Mm. And so you can be a carrier of the fire and also looking for the fire, right? It can be in multiple places in the same way that the boy, I think, is a concrete representative of the thing that the man hopes has not gone out of the world. Mm. And really, the labor to keep his son alive in part has to be based in a hope that his son is not the only remaining goodness in the world.
Mm. I love the idea of it spreading, because it calls to mind that the passage that the woman says to him, where it says she said that the breath of God was his breath, yet though it passed from man to man through all of time. And I was thinking how the breath of God is presented there almost like a wind, which it, in other places, it's almost presented as a win as well. But the idea of the wind spreading the fire, like a forest fire, you know. And so I think that the conflation of those two, not to be confused with conflagration, which is what they're after, though.
And it harkens to John 3, Jesus's conversation with Nicodemus, to blow the wind blows where it will, though we cannot see it.
Yeah.
You know, that seems to me an undeniable kind of nod to that passage, in the sense that the Spirit of God, the breath of God, the wind, there's something kind of unpredictable about it. It's how would you say it? Its purposes are its own, and sometimes difficult for human beings to discern.
As Steven Tyler says, I know nobody knows where it comes or where it goes.
Wow.
Yes.
Prophet of our time.
Prophet of our time.
Yeah, speaking of prophets, go ahead, Heidi.
So in the Grail Quest, only one knight can achieve the Grail. And we actually already know who it is. Like, it is Galahad. And we're told that from the very beginning. And yet, many, many knights go on the quest, and through the questing itself, they do not achieve the Grail, but they do achieve, in a sense, their own salvation, in a spiritual sense, and also in a worldly sense or an earthly sense, and in the sense that the quest defines the meaning of their life, and it defines the journey and the actualization, the growth of their selfhood and the growth of their virtue in the overcoming of dangers and temptations along the way. In that sense, I think that the quest itself becomes like just by virtue of going on the Grail quest, you are on a meaningful journey. Whether you achieve the Grail or not. And I think that kind of imposes a sense of meaning on the road as well. The boy might be the Grail. He might be Galahad, right? But it's fluid enough so that it's a meaningful quest either way. And in that sense, I'm not trying to dodge the question by saying yes to both, but to that actually is, in a literary sense, answering yes to both is not dodging the question in a literary sense as well. That follows the convention of the Arthurian legend.
Yeah, it's important that both can be true.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say that's the nature of good art, though.
Like, exactly.
If it's only one thing, then it's good, but if it's can be more than one thing, then it's great. You know, that's one of the defining characteristics.
But I am with Ed in that it's more the boy, because the boy is the future. Yeah. He's a child, and he is like, if the boy dies, it's a nihilist book. If the father dies, it isn't.
Yeah. You know, that's interesting, because the boy also, he is carrying the fire, and it, the word, the use of the word goodness happens constantly throughout the book. The father says, he literally says to him, you're doing good. And at first you just read it as, keep going, you're doing good.
You're doing well.
Encouraging. Yeah. But then you realize that McCarthy's doing something richer with it. But then towards the end of the book, it actually says, in like, I think the most important section of the whole book, it says, goodness will find the little boy. It always has. It will again. And there they're talking about the boy, the main character boy, the son is saying, what happened to the other boy? And the father says to him, goodness will find the little boy. It always has. It will again. But really, he's talking about the son there. And at that moment, the book switches perspective, because that's when the father dies, and it switches to the son's perspective. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the idea that goodness is also finding the boy, like goodness is on a quest for the boy as well, is like tied into the multivalent meaning of it, as either Mark or Ed mentioned. Tim, were you going to say something there a second ago?
Nothing that hadn't already been said. Okay. Well.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure you had the opportunity. Here's another question. I want to talk about whether this book is the ways in which it ends hopefully. Actually, quick poll. Do any of us believe this book doesn't end hopefully? Tim, you first.
I believe this book is very hopeful at the end.
Sean?
I believe the same thing.
Same.
Okay, the eyes have it. So, okay, I want to come back.
David didn't have to vote.
Yeah, exactly. He's three out of, it doesn't matter what I think. No, I think it's very hopeful. I want to talk about the ways in which it is hopeful. Some of them are exceedingly obvious, and one might argue too obvious, but I would never do something like that.
Nobody would argue that, right?
But I want to talk about the way this book is not just hopeful, but the ways this book is moving. Because I think that's an important part of this story and what McCarthy's trying to do. And so Heidi, for you, what scene would you put, if I say, in what ways was this book moving? What scene or moment comes to mind first for you? Or it could be a recurring motif or something like that, but what moves you the most?
So much. Like the last 15 pages, are just unbelievably beautiful. Like they're worth everything to get here. The father's last words, of course. But I think it's, for me, it's the boy protecting his father's body for 3 days.
Yep.
Say more.
That is,
and we can read some of that if you want.
Obviously 3 days, very messianic vision there. Even though it's only one sentence in the book, it's really only, he stayed 3 days and then he walked out to the road and he looked down the road and he looked back the way they had come. There's so much in that sentence. That is a loaded sentence. It's a beautifully written sentence. He's grieving, even just in that sentence, the whole book is like held. Like their whole relationship as he's looking back the way they came and looking forward and guarding, like he's risking so much to stay with his father's body. And those 3 days hold their entire relationship, including the fact that his father, that the boy probably is considering dying here. He's probably considering suicide here. And that is implicit. That's the subtext of their final conversation when the father says, I can't actually hold this, my dead son's body in my arms, right? You're going to have to, no. I'm going to have to die first. And then he leaves the choice in his son's hands. And then what his son chooses to do with that is to guard his father's body and his legacy and their entire story for those 3 days. And 3 days is so symbolic spiritually and literarily. And then he goes out and he looks back the way they came and then he looks forward. And that was so moving to me. I kind of just like sat there with the book for a couple minutes. Like I didn't want to move on. I just wanted to like be there in that 3 days. Because the boy is not exactly his father. He's better than his father. He's like a better man than his father already. And which makes him more vulnerable and yet stronger. And you just wonder what he's going to do with that. Mm-hmm. And he's so courageous. Like he's so brave of him. And then he's protected, right? And I think that to your question, or I don't know if it was a question, what you just said a couple minutes ago, what is hopeful? It's obviously hopeful that he meets a family right away. That's obviously hopeful. And is it too on the nose? I think absolutely not, because there have been so many moments in the book that were wildly meaningless in our face, including the whole premise of the book, that to have this moment that is so redemptive, I think that the only way that this book is helpful is if there's a redemption in that is commiserate with the misery of the story. And the fact that he meets someone right away can't be too much on the nose. Like it has to be, in a literary sense, the end has to provide some kind of touch point to the misery of the novel. And that moment's so powerful. But to me, the most hopeful thing at the end is the fish.
Okay, we'll get to that. We gotta talk about the ending.
Yeah.
You didn't keep reading, and I think that
I'm happy to do it.
When you read that sentence, do you have it open or should I just read it?
You read it.
So you read, he stayed 3 days and then he walked out to the road and he looked down the road and he looked back the way they had come. And you're right. That's a great sentence. It's wonderful writing. But then it says, someone was coming. He started, and then there's like the flare has been answered, right? So yeah, someone was coming, but he's not sure who it is. But then it says, he started to turn and go back into the woods, but he didn't. And through so much of the book, they've been, but there is something both courageous and hopeful about him standing his ground there. So, and part of it is that he's trying to protect his father's body, as you said, but also that there's something innate or some instinct in him that tells him that this is the person who is coming is an answer to that flare that they sent earlier.
Which rhymes with prayer.
Yes, it does. Tim, what is most moving for you about this book? Like, what is there a particular moment or motif or scene?
For me, it's the conversation between the woman and the boy. I think it's the woman embraces him, like knowing nothing about him.
Yeah.
The woman, when she put her arms around him and held him, oh, she said, I'm so glad to see you. And she said, for me also, it's the next lines. She would talk to him sometimes about God. He tried to talk to God, but the best thing was to talk to his father. And he did talk to him and he didn't forget. The woman said that was all right. She said the breath of God was his breath, yet though it passed from man to man through all of time. When my dad died, he died almost exactly 3 years ago, and I was like physically with him in the room. And I remember for days, maybe weeks, maybe even months afterward, when I would pray, I always found myself, I'm getting really emotional, but talking to my dad. I never expected that to happen. Never expected that to happen. It's like, not really part of my theology, but there was something about being there, you know, with my dad for his last months and him being my father and he was not coming back. I just wanted to keep talking to him. And I believe that his spirit was still alive. And so there was something really like just emotionally, I was compelled to continue to talk to him, even though he was physically not with us anymore. Hmm. Another reason why those lines about him talking to his dad were so powerful to me is that another of McCarthy's books, No Country for Old Men, has a very similar kind of view, right? So skip the next 60 seconds if you want to read No Country for Old Men and you don't want to know part of the conclusion. But there's a sheriff who is like, in a way, like a carrier of the light in this really dark tale. And he feels like giving up. And at one point he has a conversation with an old former sheriff who is close to dying himself. And the sheriff, So anyway, the two sheriffs commiserate about how dark the world has gotten. And then on the last pages, the sheriff is talking to his wife and he recounts a dream that he had about his father. And his father, in the night, starts a fire, a bonfire, and the sheriff walks toward the fire. And by the time he gets there, his father is gone, but he started another fire off in the darkness. And the sheriff had this sense that, like, my job is to follow my father fire to fire in the darkness. And that, to me, really syncs up so like clearly with the conclusion of this book that the keeper of the flame, the sun, is kind of following in the footsteps of his father. And I find that extremely compelling. I think it's so beautiful.
Because that line that you read, she said that the breath of God was his breath, yet though it passed from man to man through all of time. It also suggests the idea that the breath tethers them across time. Like right. The time that we experience on earth is one version of time, but the time the soul is experiencing in eternity, like can they be tethered together through the breath of God? There's some theological stuff in there as well about whether like is, you know, this are the saints, for example, outside of time. And that's why someone might say you could, you know, the saints could pray for us because they didn't exist. You know, the sense of time is just different. There's all kinds of theological stuff you could get into there, but I love the way that McCarthy deals with that in a subtle way there, while also being like really moving, as you said.
What, another thing that I find so compelling about it is that, I mean, I think just because I know a decent amount about McCarthy's biography, I think he was sort of like a man of faith on Tuesday and a skeptic on Wednesday. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so there's something about this end, which is very, in some ways, not metaphysical. You know, it's not the promise of a golden hereafter. It's very, very physical. At one father passes on the goodness of the world to his son, and hopefully that son will pass it on to his son. So it seems like a very McCarthy kind of conclusion in that he does not, how do I say it, appeal to things unseen in alluding to the possibility that there is something unseen.
Right. Mm.
Tim, what about you? I mean, Sean, what about you? What's moving for you? Sorry, Tim.
there's not much left that we haven't touched on. I do find that exchange between the father and the son when the boy asks him to take him along, right? Don't leave me, take me with you. And the father tells him that I know I promised that I would. That exchange is really moving, especially because it grows organically out of the boy wanting to be assured again that the fire is real. Right, that comes just a handful of lines before this question, essentially that he could die with his father. But it represents for the father this sort of triumph or victory. Obviously, there's a sense in which he has left, you know, ideally he would like to leave his son a strapping 25-year-old, right?
Right.
But he has brought him this far, and then in his own personal struggle, which the son has only seen bits of, but we as the reader have seen more of, with hope and despair, he has finally come to this point where only one bullet is necessary, right? His death is immediate and inevitable, and he has the means to also end the potential misery of his son. All right, that was the dilemma for a long time. Do we have the right number of bullets? But he gets to this point, and he's hopeful enough that he wants his son to live on. Right? And the whole problem with this book, with the plot of the book and the genre of the book, we've talked about it earlier, that it's a journey story. But like so many journey stories, it's usually a journey toward a home, and there's no obvious home to journey toward in The Road. And so you, as the reader, are left wondering the whole time, what is the point of all of this? Like, who cares if they get south or north or east or west, or what is there to travel to? And this seems like the father's final indication that he has some real hope that there is a kind of home worth getting to for the boy, that there's something in this world that's worth continuing to exist for. And so that I do find that what's behind that conversation pretty moving.
Me too, Sean. It makes me think there is a sort of promised land that the father is telling the son exists.
Yeah, right? Keep looking. Yeah,
but we know that that promised land might not really exist.
Yeah,
right. The father kind of, we get the father's thoughts, and there's real concern that there might not be anybody else. None of the other good guys, you know, have like made a camp on the coast.
Right.
And you guys know me, I'm very sympathetic with this kind of like existential approach to faith, which says, if you're looking for external proofs, you know, that God exists, that, the biblical manuscripts are trustworthy, that Jesus rose from the dead. If you're looking for external proofs, they are hard to not like doubt. But if you live in such a way that God exists, that Christ raised from the dead, what do you know? But those, like that way of life demonstrates its own validity. Mm-hmm. And I find something in the father's pursuit of this kind of promised land with the son. What do you know? After the father's death, the boy finds it through this family. You know, they lived in such a way, they lived with such hope, hoping that hope was worthy of hoping in. And at the end of the book, they discover it was worth hoping for. There was something to hope for.
Yeah. There's this bit of foreshadowing. You know how like through the whole book, the father said, basically, if you have good dreams, it's a bad thing.
Yeah.
And then the boy even mentions that. Well, towards the end of the book with like, I don't know, 15 pages left or something, it says that they're sleeping near the beach or whatever. In the evening, the murky shape of another coastal city, the cluster of tall buildings vaguely askew. He thought the iron armatures had softened in the heat and then reset again to leave the building standing out of true. The melted window glass hung frozen down the walls like icing on a cake. They went on. And then this bit. In the nights, sometimes now, he'd wake in the black and freezing waste out of softly colored worlds of human love, the songs of birds, the sun. As like he, in a way that that dream does, like it kind of is a bad thing. It kind of like foreshadows that he is done for, but we kind of already know that. But also it's those dreams, I think, which are pointing to what you're saying. Like that the father has these dreams of his wife or of birds and of the sun and those things. Like those are the dreams that keep him going. They verify the hope, the worthiness that, how did you put it? That hope is worth hoping in. And so that line actually comes right after something that for me is probably the most moving part of this reading. And this maybe is one of those life circumstances life circumstance readings, because as you know, when you have kids, everything changes, right, Tim? You
watch
your own mortality.
Oh my gosh. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Well,
I now have three boys. Sean, you're kind of, Heidi, you've got a 17-year-old, but you have a 17-year-old, you have two teenagers, and then Sean, you have four boys?
Four boys.
Four boys, yeah. I've got a boy who's 12 and 11, and then one who's 7, obviously. But entering this new phase of life with 12-year-old, how do you remember this? It's like a different, it's my perspective on so many things is being reshaped. And also on my, not just my own mortality, but my own idiocy. And like, there's that line where, you know, the father can be so gracious sometimes, like when the boy loses the gun. And it goes into great detail about how he has to clean the gun and get the sand out of it and all that.
And don't worry, it was my fault.
Yeah, he says, don't worry, it was my fault. And then there's the time when he yells at him. And there's like this barrier put up between them briefly. But then he says, I'll skip ahead.
This is after he's shot. Right?
It's after he got shot. Yeah. Yeah, he gets shot. Yeah, and then he says at the end of that, he's cleaning the wound. He says, "I'm sorry, I yelled at you." He looked up. "That's okay, Papa. Let's start over." Says the father. The father says, "Let's start over." And the boy says, "Okay." And then a little bit later, the boy asks him if he's brave. Mm-hmm. He says, it's you know, another 6 pages later. He says, "That hurt, didn't it?" The boy said. And he said, "Yes, it did." "Are you real brave?" "Just medium," says medium. The father. "What's the bravest thing you ever did?" He spat into the road a bloody phlegm. "Getting up this morning," he said.
"Yeah."
"Really? No, don't listen to me. Come on, let's go." But there's this, their relationship evolving in the way that it does is really moving to me, because the boy's becoming more and more aware of the flaws of the father.
Yeah.
But he doesn't, it doesn't really alter, it alters what he thinks about him, but it doesn't alter the love he has for him. And the father is more and more aware of the way the boy is growing up, and he's recognizing, and that is sometimes his anxiety, his fear about that is sometimes leading him to yell at the boy when he shouldn't, right? And it takes that starting over. And that's a very human thing. I think in some ways it's the most human aspect of this book that they sometimes have to start over. Like in moments like that, the book stops being archetypal for me in a really moving way. Like sometimes, and I'll be honest here, sometimes when I read this book, the archetypal nature of it takes me out of it. Like I find it spiritually moving, but dramatically cold at times. But when he gets into moments like that, that's why I love the dialogue so much. When they have dialogue between one another, the relationship between them gets so focused and so heightened. That's where I find it really moving me and orienting me towards the hope that Tim was talking about. If he wasn't such a great writer of dialogue, which I think, Tim, you talked about in episode one, I think that the book would not get to where it gets to. Even when he has the great prose writing that he has and he's got these great metaphors and it reads like the Old Testament and all that, that's all amazing and it shows his gift. But where he's great as a dramatist and a novelist is in creating scenes between two people who are grasping towards the same thing, but also learning so much about each other right up to the end. And so then what it has to say about the relationship between them has had me thinking a lot about being a father, especially of a boy who's entering the phase of trying to become a man. Yeah. Heidi, would you like to speak about boys trying to become men?
I wish that I knew more than I do about that.
Don't we all?
I think what you just said hit me about how human it is to fear for your children and in your fear to attack or be too hard on them and to make it harder on them to...
Yeah, just like spills out.
Yeah, because, and I feel like that without the apocalypse.
Right, yeah.
What you said just hit me about how human that is and how that ties the book. I have often asked myself in reading this book whether or not it was the... I'm using air quotes here. I was going to say whether it was the right choice, but I'm going to change it. Whether it would really would diminish the book if they had names.
Like if they were named Jack and Max or something?
Exactly.
Just like any names? Yeah.
Yeah. I see why he doesn't give them names. It makes it more archetypal. It makes it universal. But then to your point about how well this book succeeds at being archetypal, I sometimes have wondered whether if they were named individual characters, if it would help ground it more, if that could have been a simple thing that would have kept it more in the realm of the concrete. I don't know. I'm not necessarily advocating for that because I can feel already the rage against that idea.
The host post coming? Post for the host?
And so I am not proposing it. I just am
just
saying I have been speculating about that. Because I think that you're right. The book succeeds at being so archetypal that it, to your point, it is the dialogue. and this, the nature of the relationship, and the toil that McCarthy takes to name things in the book. Like, it's not just that they find food, it's that they mm-hmm. find distended cans of beans, right? Like, yeah. The book
so needs many peaches.
That. Yes. Like, the book has to
millions
have
of
that.
Peaches.
The peaches yeah. for me, right? It must have that, or else it becomes kind of an abstract fable, and that keeps it, those details keep it grounded.
Yeah,
and so in you saying that, I was like, oh yeah, I recognize that. I recognize the amount of times I have walked in a room and been like, get off your phone, right? Yeah. Because I'm afraid I'm going to lose them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that is one of the very powerful things about this novel is that it is about parenting mm-hmm. just as much as it's about, you know, the wasteland and the end of the world.
Yeah. Tim, how does this book strike you? I mean, we talked about this a little bit in episode one, but as a parent, having read the whole thing again and getting to the end and thinking about parenting, how does it hit you this time?
It occurs to me how much, how do I say this? Human beings have to learn everything. Like, instinctually, compared to even squirrels, we do not have a lot of instinct, yeah. right? Like, you can't throw us in the deep end of the pool and we start paddling like a puppy. We don't do that. We have to be taught everything. And the father is doing everything that he can to prepare this boy for his death, to live life without him. And the moment the father dies, it's chilling how overwhelmingly vulnerable the boy is. Like, yeah. he doesn't have a shot, not a prayer. And I mean, thankfully there is someone there to kind of continue to, you know, take him and rear him and protect him and feed him, hopefully. But that's one of the things. And I mean, I see with my little girl, she has to learn everything, you know?
Well, the squirrel doesn't have to deal with the anagogical, so.
That's true. The squirrel doesn't have to deal with the anagogical. Can I just interrupt and get, like, can we do like a real quick parenting corner? Just because I think it's like kind of appropriate for this time of the book.
Yeah, if ever there was a time, right?
Our daughter, 11 months old, we're with this big family and they all love her. And so there's like 12 people in the living room last night. And Arden has been standing without support for probably 3 or 4 weeks. But, and nice. She would maybe every once in a while take like a half halting step. She's a prodigy. Maybe a half halting step before she had to stop and kind of like go into a squat or fall over. Last night, you can tell. She wants to be doing what the big kids do so badly. So she's standing in the middle of the living room. Everybody's watching her. She stands up and she's like on her wobbly feet and everybody's watching her and clapping that she's standing up. And then she takes a step, another step, another step, another step. And we're like, oh my gosh, what is happening? She's walking all of a sudden. It was incredible. It was incredible. And it was really, I really do think it's because
she's
been standing for a long time. She saw the big kids do it, you know?
Yeah. She got some ideas.
Education is imitation.
That's right.
Yeah.
This fire got spread, man.
For sure.
Hey, let's talk about the very, very ending, which Heidi, you mentioned the fish and all that.
So good.
So he's with the... The penultimate paragraph is where the line that we talked about with the breath of God. Then it says this, and I have it here, so I'll just read it for the sake of time. Hope that's okay. Once there were brook trout in the streams in the mountains. You could see them standing in the amber current where the white edges of their fins wimpled softly in the flow. They smelled of moss in your hand, polished and muscular and torsional. On their backs were vermiculite patterns that were maps of the world and its becoming. Maps and mazes of a thing which could not be put back, not be made right again. In the deep glens where they lived, all things were older than man, and they hummed of mystery. Okay. I mean, that's, we could just sit there in the quiet for a minute. It's not great podcasting to do that though. So some people can pause that.
Pause right
sit
now.
With it. Yeah. In the deep glens where they lived, all things were older than man and they hummed of mystery. Heidi, you mentioned that this is particularly, I think you alluded to this passage when I asked you about things being moving or hopeful. Hopeful, I think, was what you were talking about there. Why is this passage hopeful?
Because there's life. There's fish, right? Like that, the world isn't just one generation away from death. It's not just the boy and the girl whose family he's joining, right? Like it's there's animals, there's two colors mentioned in this paragraph. And so the world is coming back to life. And how the world comes into being in the biblical story. And again, we're not saying that McCarthy is trying to make some, he's not like a secret Christian that's, he's just calling upon the biblical illusions here, right?
Yeah, there's a tradition
here. Yeah. Is life comes from water, like life comes from the deep. And it is the fish of the sea that are the first creatures other than plants in creation. And so I think this is I'm hopeful for the boy, but if it had ended with the paragraph before, the section before with the mother, I think that would have been sufficient, sufficiently hopeful, sufficiently redemptive. But this paragraph makes it universally redemptive. There is a coming back to life. There are animals, there is flowing water, there is color, there is a safe and permanent place where these people live in the glens, up in the mountains, it's hidden away. So we see like a revival, a new beginning, which makes this story tragic in the sense like that a true tragedy ends with the upward trajectory, like a restoration, like the tragedy is the stage littered with dead bodies, but a true tragedy then leaves hope then for something to come next. And this book does. I want to say to something that Tim said earlier, that I actually think that this book is much better for it being so earthy and for all of the hope being earthbound, because we are never allowed the escape of just like, well, it's okay if they die because there's an afterlife, right? Like,
right.
We never have that. Everything is at stake on every single page of this book. And that I think makes the book a triumph, like a masterpiece, because of that. And so then the fish then at the end is another piece of earthbound hope that allows us to cling not to some kind of abstract future paradise, but a real and embodied restoration or revival, renewal of this place that is worth fighting for and worth living in.
It reminds me that last paragraph of that verse from the book of Romans about nature groaned as if in childbirth, longing and expectation for the redemption of the... Yeah, right. Because that piece of... That look at the trout in the stream comes after this kind of redemptive moment of the boy finding this family, you know? And it sure looks throughout this book that nature has been obliterated, just wiped flat with ashes
on everything,
whatever the Holocaust is, on everything. But it even seems after the redemption of this boy that maybe there's even reason to have hope that nature might return. Right now it's groaning as if in childbirth, but maybe there's even hope that the ash one day might be gone, that there might be some way for the world to kind of regain its greenness.
I totally agree with that. And fish are food. Although so you know
fish
how you
are
can't,
friends.
You know how you, thank you. You know how you like can't really stay in the depths for forever. Like, that's the first thing I thought when I read this paragraph was fish are friends, not food, but they are food, actually. And so to your point, Tim, there is a renewal of nature and a renewal of the world as being self-perpetuating, right? Like that the world can again sustain life. And so all is not lost. It's not just that the boy is going forward, which is a good thing. And we actually care about this boy more than anything. Like, while I'm reading, I'm like, literally the only person on the face of the earth that I care about is the boy right now. Like, is he going to make it? Like, right. I don't care about my own children.
Well, you guys, to be fair, there's not a lot of this
boy. But yeah, I need to know if this kid's going to make it. But then when he does, it doesn't just leave us with he gets to make it yet another generation. And it doesn't just leave us with a potential wife for him, which is intentional, right?
you're saying there's a chance.
Yes. But that the world itself is going to find a way to come back to life.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It reminded me of the Hopkins poem, God's Grandeur, that ends with the nature is never spent, and even though it can seem sometimes like we have totally obliterated the world, that there is the Spirit of God hovering over the waters and preparing to remake them.
So I want to ask you one question about this passage, though.
And is it about the tense?
Well, yeah, well, I'm gonna talk about that if you want to. Okay. I don't know. Sometimes when I bring stuff up like that, I fear I'm being too pedantic.
I was afraid that I would be that too, because I always I vacillate about how hopeful I find this paragraph, and I want to find it very hopeful.
Sean, would you like to bring up? Let's don't bring up the tense yet. I want to read the paragraph one more time, and Sean, Tim, maybe you can even help with this too. And I say that here not because I don't think Heidi can help, but because I want you to know that you are allowed to talk. And I can't see your face. So,
Yeah.
What are you looking at right now, Tim? Can you set the scene for us? Are you staring out at the mountains right now? What's going on?
Oh, I wish. No, I'm in a parking lot where a school meets. It is not a moment of the redemption of nature.
Okay. Well, in some ways, maybe that's appropriate. Okay. So I'm going to read one more time because I want to highlight two sentences that I have lots of questions about. Okay, so once there were brook trout in the streams in the mountains. You could see them standing in the amber current where the white edges of their fins wimpled softly in the flow. They smelled of moss in your hand, polished and muscular and torsional. On their backs were vermiculite patterns that were maps of the world and its becoming, maps and mazes, of a thing which could not be put back, not be made right. In the deep glens where they lived, all things were older than man, and they hummed of mystery. So, Sean, it just really does tie to the tense, come down to the tense that I have a question about. So it says, it begins with once.
Yeah.
And my question is, like, once upon a time, once in the past, once
in the past, how, once,
how is that supposed to be read?
Reality? Yeah.
And then also the maps and mazes of a thing which could not be put back and not be made right again. How do we interpret the use of the past tense and the thing about things not being able to be made right again? Tim, do you have thoughts on that? And then I'll go to Heidi and then let's see if Sean feels better about it. And then I'll go to sleep.
He snaps into present tense. I'm rereading Sutri right now. Mm-hmm. And he will all of a sudden inexplicably snap into the present tense. And then he'll, for two sentences, and then he'll go back to past tense. If it was a lesser writer, I'd be like, oh my gosh, somehow this sneaked past the editor. You know, like he just made a mistake.
Sure. Yeah.
But there's something about that strategy, I think, that makes whatever you're reading like all of a sudden jump in energy. It seems to bring the action really close for a moment before kind of like returning into the normal pace of things. That's the best that I can do. And it is a little bit of a mystery to me about what he's doing with tenses.
Sam, I know you need to go, so we'll let you go here, but thank you for for being here, and then we'll finish we'll talk for another 2 minutes and then we'll go, but thanks for making the time and finding a parking lot.
We will we'll talk together for the Q&A. Can't
That's
wait.
That's right. Yep, you'll be back for that.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, see ya.
See you, Tim. All right. So Heidi, what do you think about this?
I mean, a good author is going to end his book like this ambiguously.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that and I'm not trying to dodge the question. I think you can read it either way. Mm-hmm. And I think that's intentional.
If you, what are the two ways though? Like, do you mean you can read it hopefully or not hopefully?
I think like you can read it as a dream or a memory. Or you can read it as a present reality for the boy. Either way, I think it's hopeful.
So Sean, you're saying you vacillate on how hopeful you think it is?
Well, because I think maybe there's a third way to read it, and it's as a kind of wistful commentary on this noble thing that's kind of vanishing. But I don't gravitate to that reading. I mean, it really, that last line, there were things older than man and they hummed of mystery, right? Mystery is the last word for crying out loud.
Right.
Like it is ambiguous, but it's also, even the ambiguity seems skewed in a positive direction.
Exactly.
Like the fact that it's a mystery is meant to be comforting in some way. These are things that are beyond man because they're older than man, and so you know don't worry too much about that. Like the thing's gonna work out.
I just wrote underneath that paragraph in my book in quotation marks as if in a commonplace book, mystery is the last word for crying out loud, Sean Johnson. And if that's not a good summation of the universe, Heidi, go ahead.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean the word on the about the fish is that it's a world that's becoming something. But there's also that statement that it cannot be made right, which I agree with that. Like while we are here, I'm like a very hopeful Christian person. I like pray for McCarthy's salvation every day, actually, he's in my little book, but like I still think that there are things that cannot be put right while we are here ever. Mm-hmm. And so I don't find that not hopeful.
Right.
To me, that's just honest. Yeah. And I'm grateful for someone putting it there. I'm grateful for someone speculating. Can you carry the fire in the face of the worst thing that any of us can imagine? And the answer seems to be yes. And that is unequivocally hopeful to me, even if there are things that cannot be made right.
Yeah. Yeah. Even depending on how you read the passage, I think you can even read it as saying, even if these fish don't exist anymore, even if these trout aren't alive anymore because the world has been torched, they are indicative of a kind of reality or an element of reality that is ongoing or is persistent. They are simply one example of the kinds of things which live in the deep glens and are older than man and hum with mystery. Mm-hmm. All right. Just as in the old world, when you would happen upon these streams in the mountains and you would see these brook trout as an example of something mysterious and sort of beyond reckoning. So there may still be things of that kind in this world, which the boy is left to live in.
In the Natural History Museum in Washington, D.C., there is a display connected to the meteor that they believe hit Earth, caused the extinction of the dinosaurs and all that.
Oh, yeah.
And it shows over the course of centuries how they think things would have evolved and changed after that happened, such that the world blooms again, right? And it's really, I mean, it's a educated guess kind of recreation. But when I was looking at it a couple of weeks ago when we were there, actually it was 2 months ago today, I was really moved by the way over time they think that certain, what the different kinds of things that would have appeared, reappeared at different times. So you think that there's no flowers anywhere, right? Or there's, for maybe a century, they would, this particular kind of flower, this particular kind of growth would have been gone. But then it, all of a sudden, it's going to pop up again. And so, you know, I kept thinking about that when I was reading this passage, that there is sort of, even though you don't see it, you know, if there was a man walking the earth in the century after that meteor hit the earth and the dinosaurs are gone, or if there was one lingering dinosaur and he didn't see the flowers, it doesn't mean that they're not buried there somewhere underneath the surface, one day ready to reappear. And the use of the word once there, coming right on the heels of the word time in the previous paragraph, doesn't seem accidental either. He said that the breath of God was his breath, yet though it passed from man to man through all time, once there were brook trout in the streams and the mountains. You got these allusions to time there, and it seems to be connecting those two ideas. So that, even if something can't be, to your point, Heidi, even if something can't be made right again, that doesn't preclude it from being particularly hopeful. Q&A is coming up next, so post your comments. We will create the thread over on the chat on Substack, so be ready for that. That should go out as an email as well, so you'll be able to get that in your inbox if you are subscribed either to the free or paid version of Close Reads HQ. Sean, final thoughts on this before, well, not final thoughts on the whole book, because again, we have the Q&A, but on today's
episode. That's true. I'm so glad that after putting it down the first time, I picked it back up and finished it. That's not actually my experience, but
that's mine.
But my final thoughts are tied to that, because it has been so enjoyable to read and hear other close readers saying versions of that. You know, thank you so much for encouraging me to get through this book, because I made it, and you know, man, it's made all the difference. And that's great. So if you're listening to this because you thought I'm just going to listen to the episodes and not read the book, that's just one more testimonial that really it is worth it. It's like quitting the Divine Comedy, you know, in the first third. Yeah, it's hell. But
yeah, don't quit where things are supposed to end. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Heidi, final thoughts for you.
I still think the fish are there.
Like now? Because like you think the fish are up there now?
It says that they live in the glens and they lived in the suburbs when his mom was alive. I think that the fish are in the glens and the mountains where he lives with his new family. That is the stand I'm taking. That's what I believe it is. Fish are okay. Food and friends.
I was wondering in my book, the fish, I really think the fish are still there.
I meant to ask Tim if he knows yet what fish are friends is from. Does he know
she's
where that
only
is?
11 months old.
And would he have known that just from his own personal experience? I mean, he's been around children a lot, like friends that have children, but meant to ask him. So, my final thoughts are, I was going to say that what you just said made me think that while I was reading this, I was thinking this would have been an interesting book to do a whole retreat on, because we could have done the retreat in Blowing Rock where there are plenty of glens, and this book is, you know, like the inspiration was the Appalachians, and that's the foothills to the Appalachians. So anyway, lots of glens in the area.
Yeah.
My final thoughts. That would be a really emotional retreat.
It'd be
so raw.
I don't know that it's really conducive to the.
I'm excited about Pride and Prejudice. That is what I'm excited about.
And then our event in October here in Concord, where we're going to talk about funny stuff in books.
That's what we need.
My final thoughts are going to come by way of two paragraphs in Karen Swallow Pryor's book on Reading Well.
Oh yeah.
There's a whole chapter on this book which is about the virtue of hope. So that's, I want to end by reading these paragraphs and just kind of paying, you know, giving her a shout out as well. Friend of the show, exactly. So one is at the beginning of the chapter and one is at the end of the chapter. Well, she writes this. Quote, "Such a place seems unlikely to cultivate hope. But sometimes in circumstances that seem most hopeless, hope is by necessity strengthened. Reading the story is itself an exercise in hope, similar to what one might experience reading any book of good repute, to be sure, but heightened even more by the lack of structural and narrative touchstones readers expect in modern day novels. Indeed, literary reading, reading that makes on the reader more demands of time, attention, and thought than casual reading, requires the same conditions that Aquinas finds in hope. The four conditions of hope are that it regards something good in the future, that it is difficult but possible to obtain. The practice of hope, Aquinas says, is, quote, a certain stretching out of the appetite toward good. And then I'm going to read this paragraph here. This is the end of her chapter. If we accept the central metaphor of the story, carrying the fire, then we see that after the man's death, but even before, the boy does carry it forward, and in so doing extends in some ways the man's natural life. The boy's sensitivity towards the transcendent is even stronger than the man's. It is the boy who, in his innocence, seeks to help others that the man, in his greater experience, rejects out of fear. It is the boy who, when they stumble upon a great store of food in the safe bunker underground, insists upon giving thanks, somehow, to someone, before they eat. Later, when they have reached their destination of the sea and they find the flare gun and the man explains its purpose to the boy to show others where you are, the boy wonders if somebody like God might see it. Yeah, his father answers, maybe somebody like that. Somebody like that does see the boy. After the father's death, a family who has been watching them comes to the boy's aid. They are a father, a mother, and two children. When the boy asks if they are the good guys, they assure him they are. And they are. They take him in. And sometimes the woman, the mother, talks to the boy about God. And that's the end of her paragraph. So shout out to Karen Swallow Pryor, friend of the show. Check out On Reading Well. All right. Anything else from either of you?
I'm just really glad I picked up this book after putting it down before. Read it again with friends who assured me that I was going to survive. And I did. And thrived.
Survived and thrived. Sean, anything else?
No, that's a good note to end on.
I'm glad Tim was here for this too.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Wouldn't have been the same. Okay. Well, don't forget about stuff going on over at Close Reads HQ. We've got Kristen Lovren's daughter, which is, those conversations have been great. We've got our mystery series, and we've got the daily poem, which Sean is pushing ever forward on. And the road goes ever and on, right, Sean?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Today, oh no, well, any day, I guess. But Tim would also want to mention that the play's the thing. Has rolled into the station for the end of its circumnavigation. I'm mixing the metaphors there.
Yeah, wow. I was going to say the train that circumnavigates. Yeah, that's right. Check out the final episode of the play's the thing. He is going to have more, you know, conversations every now and then that he's going to drop. But it is the end of the... He's now covered every play. So that's a great accomplishment. So, all right. Well, for Tim McIntosh, for Heidi White, and for Sean Johnson, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening. And until next time, happy reading.